Lesson today, dealing with the leaven of the Pharisees. Let me just go back and rehearse the previous eight steps that we've discussed, then we'll move on to number nine. Step number one, we admit that our single most unmitigated pleasure is to judge other people. Step number two, we have come to believe that our means of obtaining greatness is to make everyone lower than ourselves in our own mind. Step number three, we realize that we detest mercy being given to those who, unlike us, haven't worked hard for it and don't deserve it. Step number four, we have decided that we don't want to get what we deserve after all, and we don't want anyone else to get it either. Step number five, I will apply teaching and rebuke to myself before attempting to apply it to others. Step number six, we are ready to have God remove all these defects of attitude and character. Step number seven, we embrace the belief that we have been and still are experts at sinning. And then last week, number eight, we come to understand that God works with flawed people just like us. All of those steps, of course, kind of come at it from different angles. We're admitting some struggles that we have and also affirming the needs we have to step out in a new direction. This morning for the next step, we're at number nine, and step number nine is this. We are seeking to make a conscious effort to consider others better than ourselves. We're making a conscious effort to consider others better than ourselves. I want to share the opening story that our author uses in his book and kind of to set the stage for what's happening here. This particular man was in a restaurant with some young people. He'd been giving a guest seminar at a university, and he gathered with some of these young people to discuss some of the things later, and they were asking him questions, and he was answering them. And there was somebody else at another table that had listened for a while, and finally he had an outburst and said some things that were very derogatory toward the man. In fact, he says, "Your ignorance," he just blurted out finally in a loud voice in the restaurant, "your ignorance is exceeded only by your expletive deleted." All right? Some pretty rough language. And here's how he reacted to it. It says, "Needless to say, his tirade froze and embarrassed our table. His comment and unfounded anger seemed to come out of nowhere. After a few moments of uncomfortable silence, a young female student who was closest to him pulled her chair over to try to talk with the man. She was very meek and sensitive, and unlikely one to be the first to respond to him, but she had noticed earlier that a book he had with him was, of all things, a modern paraphrase of the Bible. As it turned out, the man was a Christian, albeit a highly opinionated one, and he had completely misconstrued our conversation after hearing only a few words. Our table emissary proceeded to correct his misunderstanding, and as we stood up to leave, shortly thereafter, he shook hands all around and apologized profusely. He was quite chagrined to find out that we were all Christians and appeared to regret both his outburst and his choice of words. As we drove away from the diner, there was a tendency in our group to discount the man's assessment of me by way of his rush to judgment and his unchristian-like attitude. The students were embarrassed for me, and the most readily available path toward recovering some dignity was to disregard the man by the way he represented himself. What sort of Christian would display such an attitude in front of total strangers? I, on the other hand, was troubled by something else. The more I thought about what the man had said, the more I began to be convicted by it. He may have gotten the content of our conversation wrong, but he had spotted something true about the way I was interacting with the group of students at my table. Putting myself in his place, I could see how he might have come to his conclusions about me. Many of my personal appearances at Christian colleges around the country have a similar format. Two or three chapel presentations are followed up by more informal small group discussions in classrooms, dorm lounges, and the dining hall, or as was the case here, in a restaurant off campus. In these sessions, students react to the issues I raise in chapel. often somewhat thorny issues that I know will get them thinking and stimulate discussion. These discussions usually fall into a question and answer format, with questions coming from students and answers, of course, coming from me. I began to realize as we were driving back to campus that the man was most likely reacting to my arrogance at having an answer for everything. Well, he was right. I do get used to this type of interaction, and my position can become a source of pride. He may have wrongly assessed the content of our conversation, but he had correctly interpreted its attitude. From the moment I get off a plane to appear somewhere as a guest speaker or singer, to the moment I reboard, I am somebody by way of a picture, a bio, and an honorarium fee. People who have been anticipating my coming and arranged to meet my needs during this time, and have arranged to meet my needs during this, the time that I am with them, they surround me. Funny, I never get treated like this at home. At home, nobody gives a second thought to my being any more special than anyone else in the family. At home, I have to care about those around me in order to get by. On the road, people seem to care about me without needing me to care in return. They ask me questions. They want to know what I think. And I'm eager to oblige. And I am eager to oblige. In fact, I thrive on this attention. This can easily become addictive, to where I am looking forward to the next time I leave so I can become important again. Most of us have something we excel in. Some talent or expertise we possess that sets us apart from everyone else, even if only for a moment, a day, or a weekend. If we make these defining moments in our lives, we may get a false sense of our own importance. And if we use this expertise as proof of our worth, we are only getting part of the story. I believe I was operating from a false sense of worth that evening in the diner, and the man at the next table saw it and called my bluff. I was acting like my opinion was the only one that mattered. I was the one worth hearing. I was the one to whom all questions were being addressed. I was in my element. But there were five other people with me at the table. What about them? Who probed their thoughts and opinions? Who explored their arguments? What did I walk away knowing about the people at that table that I didn't know when I sat down? Unfortunately, very little. My thoughts and my opinions were the theme of that conversation. I did not enrich myself with thoughts and opinions of those around me. I merely rehashed my own well-worn ones. I deserved the man's assessment, perhaps even his language. Again, a little bit long story there, but it makes the point, I believe. We react to those kind of things initially in a way that perhaps when we have time to reflect about it, we would want to react differently. We're talking here this morning about making a conscious effort to consider others better than ourselves, and the story illustrates the tendency to do what initially? When we feel threatened by someone or someone says something negative about us, we fall into that mode of thinking, well, I'm better than he is. How dare he challenge my way of thinking? And let me read words from the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. He really illustrates the attitude we're talking about here this morning. Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4 says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others." Biblically speaking, that's in a nutshell what we're talking about, right? A conscious effort to consider others better than ourselves. We have a biblical mandate for that right there from an inspired apostle. With humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Not to just look out for number one. This is really the opposite of step number two. I went through that list as we started, remember? What did we say clear back in step number two? We have come to believe that our means of obtaining greatness is to make everyone lower than ourselves in our mind. Remember? That's the human tendency.
Can't help but be. That's a similar thing.
All right. Yeah, it's very similar to the story we read there. Yeah, our initial reaction is to fight against that kind of input. Instead of putting people down, which is common, we need to put them up. That's what we're talking about here, elevating others. Now, this isn't to be a false groveling humility here at all. All right, when Paul says, with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves, we're not talking here about, I've got to think, put myself so far down that I can elevate someone. It's a way of considering others that elevates them. Someone said it this way: you can't respect others if you don't respect who? Yourself. Right? So pretty hard to respect others until we respect ourselves. But let's keep it in perspective here. Again, it's not that God doesn't want us to, and you know, you've got to be careful of that temptation out there about, you know, the world caters to the me generation, right? Do this for yourself. But again, we're speaking about putting others up as we seek to serve God. It's a learning experience about how to appreciate those around us. Okay? We all probably appreciate ourselves. Yeah, that's almost the default mode. And we've ran into others too that put themselves down too much. Right? That's not healthy. But probably the other is more common. It's about learning to appreciate those around us, giving validity to their opinions and points of view, even, by the way, when we don't agree with them. That's the toughest step, right? You know, I can give validity to the opinions of others and the points of view of others while I tell them they're crazy. All right? And there could be a dialogue there about ideas, but again, we can at least give validity to their thoughts, even if we don't agree. We can discuss those things in a godly way. In a more practical way, putting others, and you can think of others, be thinking of those when I finish this list here. Perhaps more practically, this idea about putting others first, about regarding others as more important than ourselves, it might be something as simple as giving someone else your seat. You know? You're on a bus somewhere. And just say, okay, why don't you take this? Or on an airplane, you take this seat. It might be something like taking the last place in line instead of scrambling for the front. It might be listening instead of waiting to talk. And there is a difference, right? There's a difference between listening and just being quiet while you're thinking about your response.
most of our listening time is spent figuring out what we're going to say.
Yeah. And when you're being quiet and just thinking about your response, you don't hear what the other person's saying a lot of times. Giving them that type of attention is a way of elevating them. It's not about looking out for number one, but looking out for number two. We can look out for ourselves. We can look out for others as well. What would be some other practical ways this might play out in our life? Seeking to regard others as more important than myself. Any other ways you can think of? And that the really
red.
Yeah, I think at times we talk about the teaching methods of Jesus and way God works things out, but you follow that storyline with Jesus teaching those men, preparing them for the task that he was going to leave to them when he went back to God. But it's almost as if that last couple of weeks there were designed just to totally break them down. Thomas, Peter, on and on the list goes that they had to be reduced to that point before something could be done. It's incredible, really, to think about the struggle that was going on.
If you're an expert on juries, and I just got a summer book, you might be able to get that.
See, all you got to do is be a preacher to get out of that kind of stuff. They don't like to have preachers on juries. So we're speaking of how to do this. And again, was there another hand again? Before
I want to say, part of my character flaw is that I truly believe that the real mark of genius is somebody that reads the Bible. We all think that somewhat.
Yeah.
And I just think, man, that guy could read, got to be smart. When they don't,
yeah.
Conversion.
Sure. And that's making those judgments right off the bat. How do I do this, though? It's a struggle. It's not natural in the sense that we talk about that to put others first over ourselves. We could go back to step number 7 and review our own sinful condition, right? A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the need to embrace the belief that we have been and still are experts at sinning. If we keep that in our minds, not, again, as a something to weigh us down, but just to keep before us the fact that, you know, I make mistakes just like the guy who cussed me out. We can do that. We can practice putting people up instead of down. How do you do that? Well, you look for things they're good at. Some people you got to look farther than others. Right? Especially the ones who've mistreated us. It's hard to find that. But probably if we work at it, we can find an admirable quality in everyone. Might be disguised, but it's going to take some work. But practice that. What are they good at? What qualities can I admire in their life? That'll help us keep people where they need to be. Practice seeing others as they could be instead of what they are. See, maybe we can say, you know, Lord, I've looked. I'm having a hard time finding an admirable quality, then just say, okay, look at potential. But again, if our focus, as hard as it might be to find something good, think in terms of what they could be, and then we remember where we've come from. See others as what they could be in Christ, while all the time seeing yourself as what you would be without Him. Right? Let me say that again. See others as what they could be in Christ while seeing myself as what I would be without Him. And on this basis, we'll always see others as better than ourselves, or we strive to do that. Another quote here I'll share, page 123. Here he tells a story about his wife. It's a section of the book says, "Everyone's a star." Says, my wife, and it's in context of doing the things we've just talked about here. He talks about how poorly he does it, but his wife is apparently pretty good at it. He says, my wife's incredible at this. She has a spiritual gift, an ability to make everyone around her shine. She finds out what makes each person unique and affirms them for that. She can work a room like nobody's business. Sometimes it is her business. And when she leaves it, eyes are brighter, steps are lighter, and this is genuine. It's as if she made her way around the room and handed each person a gift they already possessed. She has found something about them, buffed it to a shine, and held it up to the light and handed it back to them. Years ago, when she used to fly for United Airlines, ticket agents could immediately identify one of Marty's flights by the smiles on the people coming off a plane. I understand why. I have seen this magic at work time and time again and have been the recipient of it myself. She does this without even trying. Though this behavior used to baffle me, I realize now that it's not very complicated. I will admit she has a special gift for this, but it's also something the rest of us can learn. It's as simple as what Paul told us to do, to consider everyone else as more important than ourselves, or as Marty would do, to make everyone else a star. I may have been the star of the night at the diner in New York, but I could not have seen that a galaxy surrounded me. That's pretty remarkable. You know, when just you can have the type of influence that would, you can just tell by the reactions of people coming from the place where you've worked that make that kind of difference. That is hitting it on the head as far as what we're dealing with here. But I will affirm it's not easy to do. That's probably, maybe it is easy for people like this woman, but she's rare to have, you know, maybe the ability to that degree. But it is something we can all work at. It's not easy for most of us. It runs against the grain of our natural inclinations. Again, it's just not natural to view others as better than me. Most of us, in fact, are more talented at finding the worst instead of the best in others. We've talked about that enough, right? That's our natural inclination. Paul said this in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence or anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. And my initial reaction in looking at a verse like that is just to think about, in reference to my own life and my own way of thinking about myself and the world I live in. And there's probably some of that, but he looked at it in a little different way that I had never thought about before. He affirms that it's Paul asking us to work at finding something worthwhile in all that we do and everyone we meet. Think about that verse and that way of thinking in our interactions with others. We meet somebody, and in reference to that person, whatever is true, look in that life for something that's true, honorable, right, pure, lovely. It may be, those traits may be intermingled with a lot of other trash and garbage, but look for those things. I think of the biblical example of the division of the kingdom. Rehoboam, descendant of David and Solomon, had the opportunity to preserve the United Kingdom. And there were some wiser people at that time counseling him. He says, you know, if you make the load lighter, the people will follow. But he listened to the wrong crowd and made it heavier. And again, history bears out the struggles they went through. Another time's about up here, but let me share another quote here. It says, during the writing of this book, two teenage boys took to killing themselves in a Littleton, Colorado high school and taking 12 of their classmates and a teacher along with them to a violent death. That's the story of Columbine. I can't remember how long ago that's been now. 10 years already? Okay. So anyway, it says, their diaries indicated that they failed greatly. Their goal had been 500 deaths. The tendency since this tragedy has been to demonize these two, which is easily understandable, their deed being so incomprehensible and so full of design and premeditation as to be the epitome of evil and beyond belief. The media continually referred to the two as shooters, gunmen, and killers, yet they were but children, still teenagers themselves, each one still some mother's little boy. As the shock and horror surrounding this event settled in on a nation, there appeared to be two different reactions to the two boys who were responsible for the mayhem. One was to cast blame somewhere on them, their parents, the violence of the media, the school for not noticing, their peers for not telling. And I remember, you know, they were, you know, you had to find something. Another less popular reaction was to take on the blame. This reaction was stated most eloquently in a note that was tacked to the cross of the boy who seemed to be the ringleader and the one most responsible for engineering the deadly scheme. It read, "You were lost long before you died. Forgive us for not noticing." Only those able to consider others as better than themselves would see this option. Pharisees cast blame. Recovering Pharisees take blame. Jesus would have taken it. That's what his cross was all about. And I think that illustrates the idea pretty well. That's doing what we said earlier, taking a reprehensible thing and still trying to find something redeemable in all of that. Time's up for today. I would just remind you of a couple other passages from the Apostle Paul. Paul was a recovering Pharisee. And he said things like this in some of his writings. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 9, he says, I am the least of the apostles, not fit to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. And Paul was lowering himself, elevating others. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 8, Paul says, to me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ. Biblical mandate, I guess, if you will, from that apostle. Thank you this morning for sharing in our discussion. Lord willing, we'll pick up with step number 10 next week.